Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Greetings, I'm Andrew McDermott. Today I'm back with paleoentomologist Dr. Gunter Beckley, a senior fellow with Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Beckley served as curator for amber and fossil insects in the Department of Paleontology at the State Museum of Natural History in Stuttgart, Germany. He earned his PhD in geosciences from Eberhard Karls University in Tübingen. Beckley specializes in the fossil history and systematics of insects, the most diverse group of animals, and especially dragonflies. Gunter, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Andrew. Nice to be back.
In part one of this two-part series, we started unpacking an article you wrote for our flagship news website, Evolution News, called Ape Man Waves Goodbye to Darwinian Gradualism. You gave us some background on the fossil skull and explained why it's a significant blow to Darwin's theory. We'll touch on it again as we get going, and then I'd like to turn to your refutation of two other prominent examples given in textbooks today of gradualist speciation and anagenesis in particular.
Okay.
To set the stage, let me share with listeners a paragraph from your article. Darwin's theory of evolution directly and necessarily predicts a gradual pattern of fine-graded species-to-species transitions in order to climb Mount Improbable, to use Richard Dawkins' famous metaphor. This is by no means an obsolete view from Darwin's era, since Dawkins in 2009 made very clear that evolution not only is a gradual process as a matter of fact, it has to be gradual if it is to do any explanatory work. Thus, gradualism is not just some optional minor component of the theory. If gradualism is false, then Darwinism is false as well. The fossil record offers a unique window into the past that allows us to verify whether the expected gradual pattern can really be found in nature. So that was a quote from you and a paragraph from your paper that you wrote from the article. Now let's just jump into a review of what you said last, and we'll look at a few more examples. In the article, you said that Darwin himself was quite aware that the fossil record does not support his prediction. What does the fossil record actually reveal then?
Yeah, something totally different, and actually reveals discontinuities all over the place on all different levels. So there's an abrupt appearance of life, abrupt appearance of new body plans, what you could call macroevolution, and abrupt appearance and diversification of new species, which you could call microevolution. And the latter is usually followed by millions of years of stasis. So what we do not find is empirical fossil evidence for the gradual and directional evolution that is predicted by Darwin's theory. And actually, in the Darwin year 2010, there was an article by a Smithsonian paleobiologist called Gene Hunt, and he reviewed all the paleontological evidence for species transition assembled in 150 years of scientific research since Darwin. And his study is titled Evolution in Fossil Lineages, Paleontology and the Origin of Species. It was published in the American Naturalist, and Hunt concludes, and that is really revealing, the meandering and fluctuating trajectories captured in the fossil record are not inconsistent with the centrality of natural selection. That is the nod to Darwin's theory. But they probably would not have been predicted without the benefit of an empirical fossil record. And that means it would not have been predicted. Actually, the fossil evidence, the empirical evidence, contradicts the expectations of Darwin's theory. So this is not just one result, but the accumulated research in 150 years since Darwin. The Darwinian mechanism is empirically falsified over and over again. It's wrong. And people get over it. Clearly something else is going on here. On the other hand, one, of course, has to say the fossil record, there are good news and bad news for both sides of the debate. What we also do find in the fossil record is a distinct orderly pattern that requires an adequate explanation and is arguably most elegantly explained by common ancestry. But what this pattern emphatically does not suggest is a gradualistic evolutionary process, but in my view, rather a combination of common ancestry with bursts of new information introduced from outside.
Okay. Well, those large reviews of research are very handy because they look back at all the results that have been done in a certain area, and they, you know, they kind of show a big picture. And sometimes we forget that big picture. And we have to remember that, you know, in Darwin's time, the fossil record had not been duly explored and discovered yet. So that's something else to keep in mind. Well, going back to this recent fossil skull find, what was the most surprising thing about the Australopithecus anamensis find?
Now, as I already mentioned in our last talk, the most surprising result from this discovery of this anamensis skull was this coexisting of anamensis with afarensis for at least 100,000 years, which refuted this most prominent textbook example for phyletic or anagenetic speciation in the fossil record. And it's just the most recent case of many of such refutation, which have left the case for phyletic gradualism to be without any fossil support.
Well, and you refute two other common examples from the fossil record often used to support alleged gradual evolution. One group of cases involves fossil microplankton from deep sea sediment. You're finding that textbooks need updated to reflect the findings of a key study from 2009, which I love the title for. It's called Evidence for Abrupt Speciation in a Classic Case of Gradual Evolution. Tell us about these cases.
Yeah, that title is indeed quite evidently saying what's going on. So this case concerns one of the other well-known textbook examples that allegedly support this kind of phyletic gradual species-to-species transitions. And it is from a group of marine protists called foraminifers, which reveal, if you study them under a microscope, to have stunningly complex and very beautiful shells of all different shapes. And the case in question is a transition between two Miocene species of the genus Globrotalia, Globrotalia plesiotumida, into Globrotalia tumida, and it is allegedly happening within a 500,000-year window of time. Now, in 2009, there was a study by Hull and Norris who reanalyzed the data about this case and published their study in PNAS, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. And as you already mentioned, the title of their work indicates the result that this classic case of gradual evolution turned out to be a case of abrupt speciation, so the exact opposite. And in their abstract, the authors wrote, "Our findings provide an unexpected twist on one of the best documented cases of within-lineage phyletic gradualism." So what did the authors find? They found that this supposed transitional population in these 500,000 years is actually a static and cryptic third species, neither plesiotumida nor tumida, and that Globrotalia tumida appears fully differentiated. It appears abruptly and simultaneously in the whole range where it is distributed, and it appears in a geological blink of an eye. And even with some overlap, with some co-occurring with the alleged ancestral species Globrotalia plesiotumida, which again shows that this cannot be a case of anagenetic speciation if they co-occur. So the authors postulate that it's not a case of anagenesis, but say it's probably cladogenesis. They cannot positively document that it's cladogenesis, but they assume it because anagenesis is refuted. And so another of the very few published examples was gone after this study and turned out to be refuted by more modern research.
But the textbooks still need to catch up, huh?
Right.
Well, tell us about the fossil freshwater snails found in the 19th century by German paleontologist Franz Hilgendorf. Were they valid evidence for anagenesis after all?
For a time, yes. So a little bit of background. Franz Hilgendorf was a famous 19th century German zoologist and paleontologist. He worked as a curator at the Natural History Museum in Berlin and did very important and famous studies on fossil freshwater snails, planorbid freshwater snails of the genus Giraulus, which still exist. And he looked at fossils from a Miocene crater lake in the Steinheim Basin of the Swabian Alp in southern Germany, about the region where I'm originally coming from. And among these 15 million year old snails, he found various distinct shell types. And he sorted those shell types into a gradualist pattern of postulated ancestor and descendant species. And indeed, what he did is he reconstructed a phylogenetic tree very early. And he even physically drew this tree on a cardboard and glued actual fossil snails on the branches. And this physical tree was recently rediscovered by a former colleague of mine, Michael Russer, from the Stuttgart Natural History Museum. And this tree is one of the very first phylogenetic trees made from fossil organisms at all, and is widely considered and celebrated as a confirmation of Darwin's theory. However, Hilgendorf faced very early critique by contemporary scientists, people like Franz Gottschick and Wilhelm Wenz and Konrad Miller. And they all questioned that the Steinheim snails are really representing different species at all, rather than just so-called ecophenotypes. And ecophenotypes are morphs, forms within the same species, different forms, which are merely environmentally caused and not genetic, not inheritable. And this early critique was at first considered, but later dismissed by Hilgendorf, and was also dismissed by most of the later evolutionary scientists. But then came a study by Katharina Kluing and her colleagues in 2015, published in the journal Ecology and Evolution. And what they did is they studied recent representatives of the genus Gyralus in a lake on the Tibetan plateau. And guess what they found? They found all the different shell types described by Hilgendorf as ecophenotypic morphs, so just different forms within the same species in the same lake that are just environmentally caused. They are not different species, so this whole tree is complete fantasy. And the authors even explicitly mentioned the implication for the interpretation of diversity in paleo lakes like the Steinheim Basin. So this textbook example, that's one of the three most well-known and nearly only existing textbook examples for phyletic gradualism, was refuted as well. And now paleontologists are basically empty-handed concerning phyletic gradualism.
Wow. Well, it certainly takes a village in science, doesn't it? As important as original science is, and to blaze a new trail and have a new frontier and be the first, you have to come back and revisit these things and add to the knowledge that's gained from them and see what's really going on later too.
You're right, exactly. And often earlier result is overturned by a restudy of the same evidence.
Yeah. Well, near the end of your article, you say this in reference to the Darwin finch beaks, that such a minor phenomenon of gradualist evolution is not supported by fossil evidence gives reason for pause. Maybe we should not grant too much, too early, to Darwin's theory. Do we sometimes give Darwin's theory too much credit, do you think? We already know it can't explain macroevolution or large-scale changes between populations. But should we also be cautious about saying it can account for microevolution?
Yes, actually, I think that's exactly right. So I think we should be open to the possibility that Darwinism is even more wrong than we critics thought. And many people will mention this fact that we can observe microevolution within species in the lab, for example, origin of drug resistance in germs, but that does not necessarily mean that such gradualist microevolution can be extended and can be responsible for speciation and species diversification. And that is surprising, because even young Earth creationists tend to think that neo-Darwinism might explain the origin of these Galapagos finch species from an initial single founder species. But the fossil record does not really support this, and rather suggests that even for mere speciation, there is something non-Darwinian going on, a non-gradualist process that even goes beyond punctuated equilibria. So maybe it turns out that even for species transition, intelligent design is necessary in terms of abrupt introduction of new information. My favorite view, personal favorite view, is coordinated non-random mutations. And maybe that's not only necessary for macroevolution, for new body plans, but even for these minor transitions from one species to another.
Huh, very telling and very interesting. Well, final question for you today, Günther. Why do we need a paradigm change in evolutionary biology?
Now, we definitely need a paradigm change, and I think it is also on the way. There are clear signs. If you look among evolutionary biology, especially those that really work on evolutionary theory, there is a growing awareness and a growing acceptance of the fact that neo-Darwinism, that means an unguided process of random mutation, natural selection, has completely failed to explain the empirical data from the fossil record, and has also generally failed as a plausible explanation for biological origins beyond the microevolutionary level. So, of course, neo-Darwinism will not turn out to be a completely false theory per se. Usually scientific theories are shown to have, let's say later, a more restricted, limited area where they are valid. And it looks like the limits for neo-Darwinism are narrower than originally thought. And we just have to look at the proponents of, let's say, something like the so-called extended synthesis, who explore new ideas like phenotypic plasticity and niche construction and evo-devo and natural genetic engineering and hybridogenesis and whatever. But not only this, there is also a clear resurgence of non-Darwinian theories of evolution, like quantum evolution, that quantum mechanical effects play a role, DNA being in superposition and maybe collapsing into adaptive mutations, and other saltationist models that are sometimes similar to this old Goldschmidt's hopeful monster hypothesis that was recently, by the way, revived by a very eminent vertebrate paleontologist called Olivier Riepel, who wrote a book in 2017, Turtles as Hopeful Monsters. And of course, hopeful monsters, this saltationist origins, they do not really square well with not only Darwinism, but with any kind of naturalistic explanation, because they need this kind of miracle-like saltational transition. So I think that such saltational models will ultimately prevail, and that they will prove to be much more compatible and much more open to design approaches.
Well, Günther, it's so nice to talk with you, and I want to thank you on behalf of our listeners and indeed the whole research community of intelligent design for you lending your expertise to the field. It's wonderful to hear you talk about this.
So, thank you. You're welcome, of course.
Well, you've explained these fossil finds to us and why they support an intelligent design perspective on the origin and development of life on Earth. This is part two of a series. Listeners, if you'd like to hear part one, just hop on to idthefuture.com or look up ID the Future on your favorite podcasts platform. And if you'd like to learn more about Dr. Beckley's work, visit his website at beckley.at, beckly.at. Well, that's it for ID the Future this time around. I am Andrew McDermott. Thanks again for listening. We'll be back with you soon.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.